Welcome to the podcast of Trinity Church London. You're listening to a message given on a Sunday morning. If you'd like to know more about us and the life of the church, please visit trinitychurchlondon.com.
We are returning to our series of the Great I Am, where Jesus is declaring, using this famous language of I Am, that he is, of course, God. Now, many theologians have actually argued that this particular I Am is possibly the most profound. And the reason for that is two things. One, yes, we know he is clearly declaring his divinity. In fact, he does that several times throughout the passage. But also, he is claiming something quite substantial about the nature of his divinity. So this morning, we're going to keep it simple. We're going to look at two things. Firstly, we're going to look at the divinity itself, how Jesus claims to be God. And then secondly, we're going to look at the nature of that claim, why it matters so much to us, and why, therefore, our faith is so unique amongst others. Now, to understand this in context, we need to sort of set the scene a little bit. So let me just quickly do that. This is set during the Last Supper. And if you read John verses 13 to 17, the entire five chapters in John are actually dedicated to the Last Supper. So it's quite a substantial moment in time. What we can't do is just launch in at verse 1 and assume we're kind of starting at the beginning. We're not. We're actually starting quite a way through this meal. So very quickly, just to get a sense of what has come before. Okay, so I'm going to start at verse 36 of chapter 13, where it says, where I am going, you cannot follow me. So on the one hand, we have Judas Iscariot, who's just left because Jesus said he's about to be betrayed. And then he's set a new command to his disciples to love one another as they've loved themselves. And then he's making this declaration, where I am going, you cannot follow me. And of course, Peter, being Peter, is like, well, I'm Peter, you know, I'm the rock. You renamed me. I can follow you. I'd die for you. And Jesus says, no. Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So actually where we pick up is following on from that previous statement that where I am going, you cannot follow me. And so that is why Jesus says, let not your hearts be troubled. Because the disciples wanted to go with him. They wanted to follow him. They wanted to be where he was. And they could not get there. And then he clarifies, I go to prepare a place for you. And of course, what the disciples don't comprehend at the time is that he's ultimately talking about the cross, and he's ultimately talking about heaven. Better yet, he says, you already know the way. And Thomas says, well, hang on a minute. We don't even know where you're going. How can we possibly know the way there? And Jesus answers with this profound statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, there are plenty of arguments against Christ's divinity. And I'm just going to touch on three of the most common ones. And we look at the passage, and then we're going to answer those first. And then again, we're going to come back to this idea of the nature of his divinity. The first is that he was simply a moral teacher, but he was not God. The second, which I actually think is the easiest to debunk, is that he never claimed to be God. And then we've got the third, that if he was God, he wouldn't be as intolerant as to suggest that there was only one way to heaven. We're going to look at those three. We're going to understand why it's important to look beyond the obvious, beyond what Jesus is saying in his own divinity. Now, to argue the first, I'm actually not going to try and paint a picture. I'm going to leave it to C.S. Lewis because he does it far better than I can. I was trying to think through how do I, you know, unpack this passage from Mere Christianity, and I just thought, you know what, I can't do it justice. I'm just going to leave it to him. He says this, I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man, who said the sorts of things that Jesus said, would not be a great moral teacher. He'd either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. You see, throughout this passage, Jesus says at least seven times that he is God. Right? He says in verse 7, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and you have seen him. Now, admittedly, he could have been far more explicit about the way he said it, unless the reason he was saying it was to go beyond the mere observation that, yes, of course I am God and God is in me, because he tried to make a different point. So what is that point? Well, Philip says, show us the Father, and that is enough for us. He wants the big one. He wants the one that even Moses was denied when Moses said, show me your face. Now, of course, if Jesus was actually just referring to God being with him as opposed to him being God, he would have just said, well, I can't show you God's face because God is too holy. He's too righteous for you. You couldn't possibly stand in his presence and get to see him. But he doesn't say that. He says this, have I been with you so long that you still don't know me? You have seen him. You have seen the Father because you have seen me. I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. See, this is what makes it so profound. Jesus didn't say he would show us the way. He didn't say, he said he is the way. He didn't promise to teach us the truth. He said he is the truth. He didn't say he possessed the secret to life. He said that he is the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And of course, this is one of the most common critiques I hear today, at least, of this passage. You know, what about all the other religions in the world? I'm a good person, don't I get to go to heaven too? You see, the thing is, they utterly miss the point that Jesus is actually trying to make here. And to understand it, we need to look at verse 3. I will come again and take you to myself, so that where I am, you may be also. See, the world doesn't understand that Jesus here, he's not just talking about preparing a place for them in heaven. He's talking about preparing them for himself. If he wasn't there, it wouldn't be heaven in the first place. Heaven is not about a place, it is about a person. And when you understand that for the first time, you start to realize that there is no other way to a person unless it is that person. There's no point saying, well, it's fine because I just want to get to heaven, to this wonderful paradise that exists somewhere that I don't quite understand, but surely I can do it in my way, through my moral compass, through my moral code, by being a good person, by following the path that I want. But that doesn't make sense. Well, where your destination is, where you're trying to end up, is Jesus Christ himself. And if it is Jesus Christ himself, then there can be no other way aside from Jesus Christ. When Claire and I were expecting Esme, you know, we did the usual thing of preparing the house for her. Now, we were living in a two-bed apartment, and one of the second bedroom was my office, because I was working at home full-time at the time. So we didn't quite have a sort of a room for her, so to speak, but we still went to those lengths, you know, to try and make everything really cozy and comfortable for her. We had a beautiful cot set up next to the bed. We had her chest of drawers with a changing mat on top. We had a nice little picture frame with, you know, fearfully and wonderfully made. Like, we had it all, right? We had the cute little socks and all the t-shirts and all that kind of stuff, because we wanted to prepare a place for her. And then when we got to labour, which was about 4 days, sorry, Claire, and she was finally with us, she was finally born, there was a moment that I took her onto my chest. And when you have a baby, if you've had one, you'll know this, the hospital would encourage you to do what they call skin to skin. And you just sort of sit there, and you just, this tiny, tiny little human being just sits on your chest. And it's the most magical thing. And I was sitting there, and I have to admit, I mean, it had been 4 days, 3 nights, and Claire hadn't slept at all. I'd barely slept much. And so I fell asleep with her on my chest, and I kind of, middle of the night, I felt this weird stroking. Of course, I wasn't used to having a baby in my chest, so what did I do? I leapt up. Thankfully, I didn't throw, but I was about to. But I looked down, and she was still asleep, bless her. She was just in a cute little world. And I realised in that moment, it doesn't matter how amazing the place was that we had prepared for her. She was home because she was with me. She was home because she was with us, and she felt safe. You know, it's all very nice having these pictures and these lovely things for her at home, but that's not the point. You see, if heaven was just about the place, I think you could probably argue that it feels a little bit unfair, right? It feels unfair that there's only one way to get there. But when the entire point is to be with Jesus, no other way makes sense. We also need to be careful, because I don't know if you've ever done this as a Christian, if you are a Christian here today. I know I certainly have before, in those sort of slightly sheepish moments where someone sort of, you know, calls you out as being a Christian in front of loads of people who you know you're going to be judging you for it. And, oh, why are you a Christian, Rich? And you kind of go, well, you know, it's, you know, good moral principles, and it's a good way to raise the kids, isn't it? And, you know, it's all about love, ultimately. It's all about love. And actually, no, it's not. It's all about Jesus. See, far too often, we take our gaze off the person of Jesus and who he is. So the next time someone says to you, how can you be so intolerant as to believe there is only one way? You can, hand on heart, say, because I know what they're missing out on. Better yet, I know who they're missing out on. Now, I want to move on to what I think Jesus is actually doing through this passage. Because we could spend all day debating Christ's divinity. But in a sense, we still miss the point. See, on the one hand, Jesus claimed to be divine. But when Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, he didn't just make Jesus God. It made God personal. And that is the difference between Christianity and any other theistic religion on the planet. Because God's personalness makes sense of everything else that is written in his word. It makes sense of our worldview, it makes sense of our community as a church, it makes sense of life itself. Without it, we have an absolute God who is impersonal. And what a terrifying thought that is. So now let's look at this statement that Jesus makes through that lens. When the way is personal, we're not only offered forgiveness and a path to heaven, we're given the grace to change. Rather than striving alone to meet kind of some weird standard that God has set for us, we find redemption and transformation through God who intimately knows us. All warts and all, he knows every flaw, every mistake we've ever made, and he still chooses to love us. And despite that, pours out his love and mercy on us. When the truth is personal, the word becomes flesh. You know, Christianity isn't some sort of philosophical way of living. It's not an ideal. Okay? It's not a principle. It's not a way in which we have to navigate life. It's a person. It's the person of Christ. It's an intimate relationship with the divine. You see, a personal God, we sang about this morning, a personal God is not distant, but he is someone that we can actually experience. You know, when we come here on a Sunday, we don't have to just stand and sing. We can actually experience the joy of the Spirit in our lives. How often have we talked about joy this morning? We get to experience that in a way that we couldn't if he wasn't personal. We have a God who listens, who understands, who genuinely cares about your life and my life. All the details. And when the life, is personal, life becomes purposeful. See, if we didn't believe in God, we'd argue that we're just tossed left and right by the universe, some kind of force, or up to our own good. But when we believe in God and that God is personal, then each and every one of us has been intentionally created for a purpose. Your life, every decision that you make, every struggle that you go through, every pain, every tear that you shed is actually part of a significant and greater divine narrative. Because we have a personal God. The life is personal. William Barclay, in his commentary on this, said, here is a great fundamental truth. Jesus does not only give advice and directions. He takes us by the hand and leads us. He strengthens us and guides us personally every day. I am the way, the truth, and the life. It is not just about Christ's divinity. It is about God's personal nature. Now, what does that actually mean for us? I want to return to the first verse, which says this, let not your hearts be troubled. Let not your hearts be troubled. Now, John Piper, the American pastor, when he sort of looks at this passage and he preaches on it, actually, he talks about an unholy turmoil, which I have to admit kind of surprised me, and I kind of dug into that a little bit to really understand. But one of the things he says that is beautiful is this. He says, Jesus never said we'd have a life without trouble, but he promised that we could have an untroubled heart, even in a troubled life. And I think the key to this, Jesus actually says himself in verse 1 and 11, at the beginning and at the end of this passage. And I'm going to read them together, but I'm going to emphasize the bits that I think he's really calling out. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. Believe in me, believe me. Believe in me, I am the divine, but believe me, I care, I'm personal, I'm loving. Now, if you're not a Christian here today, I want you to know Jesus. I really, really want you to know Jesus. But it's not so that I can beat you in some kind of philosophical argument about Christ's divinity. It's so that you get to experience and enjoy the person of Christ. That is the point of our faith. That is why we are here. Now, let's be honest. A lot of us go through challenging times. I think most of us go through challenging times a lot. And how often do we feel troublesome? You know, we feel isolated, we feel lonely, we feel anguish, we feel in pain. You know, we start to question God. We sort of say, well, come on, Lord, why can't you just, you know, Claire's not here again. Actually, it's more to do with Esme this time because she's ill. But, you know, why is Claire still dizzy after a year? Surely, Lord, if you were a kind God, that would not be the case. But the truth is we simply don't believe him when he says, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. We can doubt his promises, we can doubt his goodness because we simply do not believe enough. And so what I want to do this morning is just encourage us, both in what Jesus says in this passage and then beyond it. Believe in me, believe me. Because Jesus is urging them, he does it several times. He says, believe in me, I have the authority to prepare a place for you in heaven, to raise you up at the last day. Believe me, in my Father's house are many rooms. You will not miss out because I do not lose one who God has given me. Believe in me, I will come again, conquering death, conquering sin, and bringing righteousness with me. Believe me, you don't have to earn it. I will take you to myself. You don't need to find the way. You just have to believe in the way. Because I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I've written a few statements up to hopefully just try and bring this to life a little bit. Because if we are to believe what Jesus is saying here, then the answer to a troubled heart is to believe in him and believe him. And there is a sense of the divine and a sense of the personal in everything that Jesus does. You know, from a theological standpoint, we talk about an absolute God, a God who is absolutely fundamental in all ways. He is unchanging, he is all-powerful, he is omnipresent, omniscient, and all the other omnis that occur with that. But at the same time, because God is also Jesus and Jesus is also God, we have a personal, loving, relational friend that we can call Father. Believe in me, I have conquered death. Believe me, I have called you by name. Believe in me, I have the power to forgive. But believe me, my power is made perfect in your weakness. Believe in me, I create the heavens and the earth, the mountains and the sea. And believe me, I chose you and knitted you together in your mother's womb. Believe in me, I flung the stars in the sky and they declare my glory. But believe me, I choose to call you my crown of beauty, my royal diadem. Believe in me, I have the power to grant eternal life. Believe me, I know what's worrying you in this life and I deeply, deeply care. Believe in me, I gave life to every living creature on the land, in the skies, and the sea. But believe me, I adopted you as my daughter and as my son. Believe in me, I parted the sea and calmed the raging storm. But believe me that when life feels overwhelming, I nestle you in my everlasting arms. Believe in me, I spoke creation into existence with a word. But believe me, I hear every word that you say. I hear every prayer and I see every tear. Believe in me, I command legions of angels and the forces of heaven. Yet believe me, I am with you in every moment and I will never forsake you. Believe me, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. But believe me, I know every hair on your head and I count them as precious. Believe in me, I know every hidden thought and secret desire that goes through your mind. But believe me, I still want you to tell me what you're thinking. Believe in me, I uphold the universe by the power of my word. But believe me, I chose to make my home in you. This is the God that we have. Divine and personal. He's not just a way, he is the way. He doesn't just declare the truth, he is the truth. He doesn't just have the secret to life, he is the secret behind a joyful and abundant life. We sung a song earlier, I think it was actually spontaneous, more love, more power. And in a sense that those two phrases kind of perfectly sum up what I think it is that this passage actually says to us. So I was going to reread the passage because it almost felt like when you start to really glimpse Jesus, the person of Jesus, his personal nature through this, and you start to just see these words come to life in a slightly different light. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that? I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where you are, where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I'm going, because I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.